Good morning, this is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Every day there are reports of crimes being committed and people being arrested. But how do those crimes affect those involved, both the criminals and their victims, long after a sentencing?
Restorative justice asks crime victims to come face-to-face with convicts. But what would make anyone, victim or perpetrator, want to get involved with this type of program?
Freelance writer Zach Brook wondered that very question. He immersed himself in a restorative justice program for 3 days at the Green Bay Correctional Institution to find out why people get involved and the impact the program has had on both crime victims and those who committed past crimes.
The result of Brooks' experience is an article called Behind the Walls, which is featured in this month's edition of Milwaukee Magazine. Brooks spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski about the program, and he began by explaining exactly what restorative justice seeks to do.
Restorative justice is a concept, I want to say it's emerging, but really it's been around since the early 1990s. It is a theory of justice that assesses and tries to repair the impact that, or the damage that's caused by crime. I want to stress right off the bat that it is a supplement and not a replacement for the traditional criminal justice system. It's just that in the criminal justice system's very narrow but vital and legitimate functions of trying to try, convict, and sentence criminals, sometimes there are things that fall by the wayside. Some of those things are the impact to the victim, the impact to the community, maybe even the impact to the offender and definitely the offender's family. And that's where restorative justice tries to pick up the ball and ameliorate that to the extent that's possible by acknowledging that just because somebody was sentenced doesn't mean that the victim's trauma is over.
So you take us through a 3-day process of victims meeting with inmates, and to be clear, it's not victims meeting with the inmates that did the crime directly against them. It's kind of a hodgepodge group. But what kind of criteria do both parties need to meet before participating in a restorative justice program?
Yes. Well, as I understand it, let me just say that's correct, that the victims that meet the offenders here are totally unrelated. It's not the offender that committed the crime to this personal victim. There are restorative justice programs set up like that around the country. This is not that, though. This is just victims. But that being said, many of these victims have experienced crimes that are of the same nature that the men in the room are serving time for. The victims, how they are chosen, well, that's the toughest part of the program, I got a sense of. I mean, it takes a special type of person to be able to share that story about themselves and to share it in a room with people who may have done the same thing. And they are vetted by victim services at the corrections department. Judge Geske recruits people that she knows from her time in the community and on the bench if she feels they're ready. And the prisoners, not just any prisoner can sign up for this class. The restorative justice component is 3 days of a larger weeks-long class that's taught by Virginia Vandenbranden called Challenges and Possibilities. To enroll in the restorative justice component, and I think the class as a whole, the inmates have to be kind of exceptional. They can't receive any infractions. And as I write in my article, it sounds like it's relatively easy to pick up infractions at a prison. If you don't tuck your shirt in, if you pull too many napkins, these type of things. So the inmates really have to be on the ball to be in this class.
And as you mentioned, you highlight a previous skeptic of restorative justice, former Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Jeanine Geske, and the advocate who converted her, Virginia Vandenbranden. How did each of these women find themselves getting involved in restorative justice?
Well, as I understand it, Judge Geske, she was a circuit judge here in Milwaukee in the 90s, and this was before she later went on to serve on the Wisconsin State Supreme Court, but this was when she was just a bench judge here in Milwaukee. Vandenbranden was working, I think, at Kettle Moraine Prison, and Geske had done not restorative justice, but she had gone in to have some sort of class with prisoners before just to talk about sentencing and, I think, judicial expectations post-sentencing, like, you know, how you're supposed to behave yourself on probation and stuff like that. So Vandenbranden was the one that brought the concept of restorative justice to Judge Geske. Geske initially was very skeptical. She did not think that victims would want to talk to offenders, and she might have been skeptical of what offenders could possibly get out of hearing this. I mean, you know, you'd think it's not that much of a stretch to think that it would turn into victims berating offenders for their offenses, the offenders shutting down. So she was skeptical off the bat. Van and Brandon tried for years, and finally, she had moved to the Green Bay prison by this time, but finally convinced Judge Geske to sit in on a session that was led by somebody else. And Geske, by all accounts, fell in love with it right away. It was a transformational experience for her. And the session was led by an attorney who lived in the Milwaukee area at that time. He's since moved out of state. But after the session, he invited Geske to co-lead the group with him. And they did that for a number of years until he moved. And since that time, Geske has been doing it all by herself. And she says she'll continue to do it as long as Vanden Branden's involved with the program, because she has so much respect for her and the program. One thing real quick that Geske did tell me, for a while she was named the interim county executive of Milwaukee. And that was only a couple of months. And she had a lot to do, but she still found time to take 3 days away to go to the program because it was that important to her.
Right. What do these 3 days look like? In your article, you highlight there's a blanket and a candle in the center of the room, and also objects that people pass around to take turns talking. So over the course of these 3 days, what was the general structure of all of these different people from different walks of life discussing what happened to them?
Sure. Well, there were 27 inmates in this class. They were recruited, as we got into before, but there were also a bunch of law students. Judge Geske was also a professor at Marquette. I think she's since retired, but the class is still offered. It's just gone from like a three-credit class to a one-credit class. But there were a bunch of law students from both Marquette and UW-Madison who were up there for college credit. In addition, there were some community volunteers. I remember one man was working as a meteorologist, but he took time away because he really enjoyed restorative justice and the feelings that come out in that room. There are a lot of former law students who have since graduated working as attorneys in the state who were so moved by the program that they decided to come back if they got a chance. And they didn't stay all 3 days because of obligations, but they stayed a day here and there. The room itself, it's just a huge classroom because there were close to 50 people in there, maybe more. And we're all seated in a circle. In the middle, there is a candle that Judge Geske got from prisoners in Northern Ireland. There's a blanket. There are lots of boxes of tissues. Crying is not out of place at these events at all. And for the 3 days, we just go around a circle. Sometimes Judge Geske will start the discussion by asking a question, but we go around a circle, and the only person that can talk is holding this talking piece, which in this case was a hand-painted stone. And she starts off the first day, the goal is to just to get everyone comfortable with each other. These are prisoners, these are law students, everyone's kind of sizing each other up. And it's to get everyone comfortable enough to share the kinds of things that are shared in the group. That afternoon is dedicated to an exercise. It's like the only lecturing that happens the entire 3 days, where Geske kind of goes over in broad strokes what restorative justice is, and then asks the prisoners and the volunteers to apply it to a situation. The second day is all about the victims coming in to tell their stories. And that takes almost the entire day. Then there's time for a quick circle at the end of the day. And the third day is about the prisoners' reflections. How did they respond to the past 2 days, especially the victims? And that afternoon is dedicated to a skit, which is a little lighter than everything that's preceded it.
Yeah, and restorative justice highlights the ripple effects of criminal actions and less about guilt for the inmates. But what do you think these crime victims and the inmates get out of these sessions?
The crime victims, well, one, I specifically remember saying that she gets the strength to identify and continue life as a survivor, not a victim, but as a survivor. It's hard to describe when you're not there to experience it, but it's a very welcoming, empowering feeling that kind of comes through that room. The victim tells their story. Everybody acknowledges that victim went through hell, but came out on the other side. And it's a very empowering experience. And I think the survivors feel that, and that's why they keep coming back. Also because they hope to influence the actions. A lot of the prisoners, this is a maximum security prison. It's not at all unusual that prisoners are there for life and they're not getting out, but some are, and the victims want to prevent more crimes from occurring. What do the inmates get out of it? They get a chance to talk. In prison, they have to be very tough, wear masks just to survive, and a lot of people don't tell these vulnerable stories that they are really sharing in this circle.
And what touched you the most as you observed these sessions over the course of 3 days? How did you notice the relationships between all the participants change as the days continued?
Well, I would say what touched me the most was day three. After the survivors had spoke, the prisoners went back to their cells to reflect on it. Traditionally, Judge Geske says, many, many offenders have trouble sleeping. They're thinking about a lot of this stuff for the first time. They're thinking about their own crimes. So Geske gives them an assignment, just write something or create a piece of art, whatever your talent is, whatever you're good at, for the survivors that spoke to you today, and give it to them tomorrow. And day three opens with the offenders just presenting whatever it is they made. And it was just incredibly powerful to see how they had been moved by these survivors' stories. That to me was just jaw-dropping.
Do you have any examples?
Well, yes, I do. There was a lot of artwork, but the things that I remember, the things that were most moving, were the poems, particularly one that the offender had written from the perspective of one of the victim's attackers. This was the survivor that had been sexually assaulted, and this offender put himself in the shoes of her attacker and wrote an apology. And I brought it here, and this is how it goes. It says, "Joan, my actions were unacceptable, the detestable things I did to you. You should never have been subjected to the cruel and inhumane treatment I put you through. I had no right to touch you. You did not belong to me. The predicament I put you in that day is one nobody deserves to see. I can apologize a million times, but I know it does not suffice. My actions set off a chain reaction that nearly destroyed your life. I took away your security and made it no longer safe in your town. Your one unfortunate encounter with me has turned your world upside down. But I'm still saying I apologize, something I didn't have the decency to say face to face. I apologize for the pain I caused you and your family, and for being the reason you were afraid to stay in one place. I apologize for all the nightmares and sleepless nights you had to endure. I'm sorry I took an act of love and turned it into something so impure. I'm sorry I violated the sanctity of your marriage and for all the problems I caused. But for making you question your belief in humanity, I apologize for that most of all."
Wow, that was a really powerful poem. Were there any other moments or stories that impacted you that didn't make it into this article?
Oh, there were several. There were 27 offenders in that room. You know, there were victims. There were law students that had really sad stories or powerful stories. One of the survivors that I write about was a victim of sexual assault. One of the law students related to that, shared her experience. Another law student actually talked about his own father being in prison for a time and the impact that that had on him. Many of the offenders spoke of their own children and how they were sad that they couldn't see him. So there was a little crossover there. One in particular that I can think of that didn't make it into the final story just because I couldn't tell everyone's was there's older offender. His name was Flores. He talked about having a son that he was very proud of. This was a son that avoided going down the paths he had and had graduated high school and had signed up for the military. Flores, as best he could from prison, tried to advise his son in life. You know, he warned him about drugs. He warned him about the dangers of unprotected sex. So they had these real adult conversations. What Flores did not think to warn him about was alcohol. And the night before his son shipped off to boot camp, he had a going away party and he drank himself to death. He died of alcohol poisoning. And that was one of the most moving stories. I heard a lot of tragic stuff over the 3 days, but that one sticks with me.
Did you find like a common strength in all of these people that were willing to come and share their stories together?
Absolutely. I mean, the offenders, I don't want to let them off. You know, they did what they did. They all know it. And that's why they're there. I think Judge Geske, she's actually led previous groups where there have been people that she sentenced from her time as a judge in the group. I remember one story there that they told us. There was a man, he was a serial rapist, and Judge Geske gave him something like 250 years, so he wasn't getting out. And he showed up to one of her sessions one day. They were going to take him out, but Geske insisted that he stay. He came up to her and said, I want you to know I'm not mad at you because I deserve to be here, but I'm mad because I can't see my kids. Anyways, acknowledging that crime deserves punishment, a lot of the offenders have been through just terrible stuff in their life, just terrible. And in their own way, they're survivors of many things. And there is that sort of commonality, that link. And I think just the understanding that things that had happened to both the survivors and the offenders were bad, they shouldn't have happened, I think that that gives rise to a lot of peace.
Do you think restorative justice will play a bigger role in the prison system? The program that you highlight is in Green Bay, but do you see it moving to other major prisons?
Well, you know, it's hard to say what corrections is going to do in this state and anywhere else. What I can say is a study looked at restorative justice, multiple studies, but a big one from 2014 was kind of a meta study that analyzed a lot of different smaller studies. And they found that it does lead to a modest but cost-efficient reduction in crime recidivism. Anecdotally, the assistant warden or the deputy warden up at Green Bay told me that the prison makes offenders better inmates and has produced remarkable changes in some cases. So I think that if it's possible to make it available on a wider scale, I really would see no reason why you wouldn't want to.
Well, it's a great story with great people and a great impact that furthers beyond the pages here. So I'd like to thank you for coming in and talking about it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Zach Brook is a freelance writer based in Chicago. His article on restorative justice is in the March issue of Milwaukee Magazine.
He spoke with Audrey Nowakowski, and you can find more about the article at WUWM.com.